Actually, howdy, y'all.
Howdy.
I reckon I left my hat under the table there, but I got a stuffed head, and I think the voice goes with the hat.
Do you care? Do you do slides?
No, I'm not going to do slides.
Sweet!
There is some stuff I want to show you later, and we'll set it up later. You know, I went back and forth trying to think about what exactly to say here, because I spent the last, maybe 3 years working on understanding fun and on thinking about how games work at a really fundamental level, at like an atomic, tiny game system, how things fit together kind of level. And, you know, I conclude games are mostly about learning, and if you want to know more about that, you can go read the book, right? And that was good. That was useful. It helped me a lot. Around the same time that I was doing that, you know, I gave that initial talk back at the Austin Game Conference in 2003. And I started working on game grammar stuff in 2004. And then I wrote the book. So there was a whole bunch of game grammar stuff that was in the book. And this whole game grammar thing, it was about common elements that are in all of the game systems, and how if some of these little elements are missing, then a game system won't be fun. It was about things like how some games are symmetric and some are asymmetric, and how all games happen within a topology, and how you always have assets to maneuver, and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff like that, you know, how games are structured around. How I have it written down. Solving statistically varied challenge situations presented by an opponent who may or may not be algorithmic within a framework that is a defined systemic model, blah, blah, blah. I'm not the only guy doing this, okay? I mean, when Mark shows his graphs, I immediately go, funny, I saw that same graph on Dan Cook's website about 6 months ago. And for that matter, I saw something very similar on Ben Cousin's website about a year and a half ago. And a lot of people are working on basically the same stuff, right? I mean, I put up a very similar graph to that one, arguing that socialization in a multiplayer game requires downtime because you need attention troughs, which look exactly like the troughs that were in Mark's graph. And, you know, Ben Cousins, we've got Stefan Bura, he's been working on game grammar. Andrew McLennan's been working on game grammar. There's all of the work that Eric and Katie did that's in Rules of Play. You know, we're all getting results that seem to work. What we're finding is that there are, you know, essentially, you know, grammatical rules or physics rules or whatever under this stuff that can be found and that are helpful. I could talk to you for hours about that crap. I've learned a lot from it, right? It's had a huge impact on how I see games. And ironically, I haven't hardly gotten to work on any games since I came up with it. But it has actually had a huge impact. And I think it can have a huge impact on the industry as a whole, right? You can see how tools like what Mark proposes, or, gosh, if we had something that you could diagram, you know, a notation, this is what I argued in the game grammar talk, where you could sketch out how the pieces in a game system fit together, you could actually see where the balance is going to go out of whack or why a system wouldn't be fun before you started implementing it, right? It's just another way to play test. But honestly, I don't want to talk about that. For one thing, it's kind of dry and technical and full of diagrams, and, you know, for another, it might, sometimes it feels a little stupid and pointless, right? Like you're caught up in the theory and you go, well, but where's the fun? And, you know, arguably it breaks George's wall between science and art, which, you know, well, a wall full of holes already, but I really want to go a little further into the future, actually, and just take for granted that all of those efforts aren't stupid, that they're actually showing us something about games. Because of the conclusion it led me to, I concluded that just about all games are about math, right? They are not about arithmetic, unless you're playing an RPG, but but about all fields of math. In fact, they tend to be about, you know, I'll go all geeky on you, they tend to be about NP-hard or NP-complete problems. They tend to be about, you know, I actually went and looked up on the web a list of NP-hard problems, and they sure as hell sounded a lot like our games. Motion planning on a plane with polygons. Yeah. Well, there goes every single platformer there is, right? Isomorphism. All our matching games, right? Traveling salesman problem. You know, packing problems. Tetris is a packing problem. Right? Well, most, a lot of other games are packing problems. Yeah, you know, exact cover problems, especially in competitive games, the NASDAQ problem, blah, blah, blah. You know, a lot of them are about NP-complete problems. In fact, I actually started the exercise, I went on Wikipedia, there's this wonderful list, CARP's 21 NP-complete problems. And I started at the top, and I started designing a game for each one.
Minesweeper was proven NP-complete.
And of course, you know, there's... You really don't want to ask.
Just
version.
One sentence.
It's basically, there's more to just NP-hard and NP-complete.
Yes.
There's a bunch of NP and P terms there. There's a bunch of them, and they all relate to how hard is this and can you solve it by tackling it with an algorithm or intuitively or not.
You're forced to guess over the first. And then NP-hard problem, which just means ultimately you just have to guess and guess and guess and guess until you get it.
Okay. Thank you.
And then, you know, besides those classes of problems, I mean, games rely heavily on estimation of probability, which isn't actually even complicated, but the human brain sucks at it and appears to be hardwired to suck at it. And therefore, we rely on it in our games a lot because we know that we can sucker them every time, right? Just like pigs. So, you know, the more I dug into grammar and all of this stuff, the more I kept going, wow, oh, crap. It may be that games by nature are inherently math. And I think that sucks. It makes me really unhappy. So, I wanted to actually show you something. You know, I was recently working on a game about
flapping.
It sounds like a really odd thing to make a game about, but I wanted to try anyhow.
There you go.
There you go.
Ah, perfecting the image.
It's pretty good to start with, but now it's perfect. Get a little keystone.
Question: whether it will show what I want to show or not. Just thinking. The answer is no, it won't. So if anybody wants to come see this later, I will show you properly. I was working on this game about flapping, and it's actually up on the blog. And you know, it's basically a little game where one key controls one wing, the other key controls the other wing. And the longer you hold them down, the longer your downstroke goes. And when you let go, the wings slowly return to where they're supposed to be. But because you have independent control of each wing, you start doing this, you're going to start drifting this way. If you hold them long strokes, you move in a different way than if you hold them slightly. And if you beat on a regular pace, you actually rise in the air. And if you hold them tight, then you stop flapping and gravity starts taking it down. Flapping simulation, right? It was keyboard input because that's what I have on my laptop. And so the thing about this little flapping thing that was, you know, it wasn't about flight, it was about flapping, which is an important distinction. And, you know, I built a little model here, and I even made it so that the keys were on opposite ends of the keyboard, so that you have that sense of, you know, steering like that. And I was thinking in terms of, you know what, a lot of game is driven by interface and by that experience. And so if I completely change up the interface for how we think about flying something, maybe I'll get to something that feels fresh. And just flapping the bird around the screen actually turned out to be compelling for me. Other people, however, bounced off of it instantly because they just didn't get it. And they asked for mouse control, actually. which, you know, I resisted mightily because I was like, well, then it's You know, if the game was about the flapping, and if you can't hack the flapping, then tough shit. But the thing about this was, it ended up being compelling enough. I posted the prototype to the blog, right? And it actually got listed on Boing Boing, which meant that it sold a few thousand units, so to speak, because a bunch of people downloaded it. And it got reblogged all over the place. So it was compelling enough that I added islands that scroll down below and a blue background with sparklies in the water and color shifting clouds and a day-night cycle with beautiful pastel colors and motion blur across the screen and all this other stuff. And that was cool. And a lot of people, those who could hack the flapping, started commenting about how zen it made them feel, particularly once I added a little dadgad-based soundtrack to it, acoustic guitar. So it was a toy, right? Because all you did was flap. If you successfully made it to the top, you were rewarded with a slight, I built a tiny little dynamic music system. If you made it to the top, you got, it was building, basically I recorded lots of little chopped up little riffs, and you got different riffs depending where you were on the screen and what angle your wings are at and all that kind of stuff. You know, really basic. And that's fine, and people said it was zen, but it wasn't what I would call a game. It was, it was a toy. It was an amusement. So I put a game into it. I made a 3D path in the air that went, went up and down. Now keep in mind, this is an overhead view game. So 3D means it got bigger or smaller. And you can see this roller coaster path wending around. There was wind blowing you from side to side that you had to cope with as you flapped. You were scored, you had to stay on the path, not too high, not too low, Basically an overhead version of flying through rings. If you got off the path for too long, you croaked, game over. Which is really frustrating because the main attraction was getting further so you could see what noon looked like because of the color ramps on the clouds. And pretty much all the charm that the prototype had went away. It ceased being fun because the math came in big time. So, here I am, and I've been looking at all these games in terms of the math. I've been looking at how you make these games, and you work with them on the systemic level. But lately I've been dreaming of making games that make you feel what it's like to be a wolf living in the winter, scrounging scraps from a nearby mining town, or a game about the sensation of a kaleidoscope, or a game that exudes tree-ness. And fuck, the math doesn't tell us anything about that. It's really, really bad. Now, I think that these aren't things that reduce down to math. And as designers, we're really trained from really few sources overall. I mean, when I really dig into the sources of influences, I mean, we already saw this even with the talks today, right? We point at other games and we point at movies. And that seems to be like the total extent of what we have been. When a designer adapts the sweep of history, like Sid did with Civ, and the development of civilizations, he builds a spreadsheet. History is a spreadsheet, right? And it's represented by pretty icons, but it's a spreadsheet. When a designer tries to capture the inner soul of a person that forms the inner core of someone, Will makes 8 bars, and they can be raised and lowered by doing dishes, watching TV, and peeing at the right time. Right? And it's a spreadsheet again, right? All of human aspiration. And it's 8 variables moving up and down. And when we try to represent a mystic moment in life, what Lorca called duende. You guys ever run across this word? It's a wonderful word. It's that elusive moment of transgression of the unreal into the real, when you could almost call it magic. It's a mana bar and a list of spells about glowing missiles. And I think we're prisoners of our math. It's ironic because we keep chasing story, right? I mean, we chase after story. And we suck at story, I'm sorry. I mean, we're really, really, really fucking bad movie makers, people. We really are. We're just no good at it. And so what we do is we make bad movies and then we stick in some gameplay that we mostly stole from 5 years ago and we say, in order to get the next episode, you must do this, right? And That's advancing the medium. That's what we're doing. And it's like, great, so in order to get to the next page of Gone with the Winds, I have to play with a spreadsheet, and then you get the next chapter. So, you know, just to broaden our sense of influences a little bit, like, look at the, you know, you guys all know that I came out of, I actually came out of academia before I was a game designer, and I was to my everlasting dismay, I was mostly studying modernist literature while getting a creative writing degree. And I really hated modernism, actually, which is why I took so many courses in it, so I could argue with the professors. When you look at the modernist movement, and I'm actually going to broaden modernism a little bit and, you know, really talking about everything kind of from the Impressionist period on forward, right? Because all of that really is influenced by kind of the modernist ethos. You know, what was going on there was there were artists and writers and musicians who got tired of showing things as they are, right? The height of craft before that was to say, look, this is what it is. So, you know, when you listen to Mozart's Requiem, he is representing as accurately as he can with his medium a certain set of emotions. And when you look at a Rembrandt portrait, he's showing you what is, right? And it's not strict realism, right? But it's showing you what is. And, you know, the same in you know, the realistic novels, oh God, the Victorian novel. Anyway. But instead, once Impressionism kicked off, and as we moved forward, we started getting people who wanted to talk about how they showed what they showed with what they used, if that makes sense. So we got paintings about color theory, right? Or paintings about how light reflects, right? Impressionism is about, in pretty much all the media, Impressionism is not about what's there. It's about how what's there is perturbing everything else. This is why I say that Minesweeper is actually an Impressionist game, right? Because you never actually see it. You see everything around it and how it's been bumped and jostled, right? So Impressionism isn't painting the lilies, the water lilies, it's actually painting the light bouncing off the water lilies. It's about what isn't there, right? And you know, God, Virginia Woolf wrote a book called Jacob's Room, which is about this World War I soldier named Jacob who's dead. He's the main character in the book. And he's not in the book, right? Because you learn about Jacob only through what everybody else says. Gertrude Stein wrote an autobiography of herself from the point of view of her lover, who was real. So it's called The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, who is a real person, and she wrote it from her lover's point of view, and she's a character in the book, and it's actually her autobiography, only she's not in it. Right? I mean, that kind of thing. And you know, the next step after that, I mean, Picasso did most of this in painting, is to start saying, okay, well, let's do paintings about perspective. Let's do paintings about facial recognition. Let's do paintings about color weight. You know, Mondrian, all of Mondrian's body of work is what they make you do in the first 3 months of a visual design class in an art major. It's about how heavy is red. You know, which isn't actually a stupid question if you study art theory, but how heavy is red and how big is empty space between two very narrow lines and stuff like that, right? So it's all about itself. And in music, we got music that was about harmony or about how melody works, right? Which is why eventually, once you get to the postmodern, you start getting stuff like John Cage, who will actually do a recording of 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence in order to make you think about whether there is any such thing. And when you go to perform 4 minutes and 33 seconds, you walk on the stage with a piano, you close the lid, and you sit there. And after about 10 seconds, what you're listening to is the concert of fidgeting, coughing, sneezing, wondering what the hell is going on, right? And there's so many examples of this, right? You end up getting writing about writing, you get painting about painting, music about music. And lately I've been wondering if all game design isn't modernist. by its nature. Whether at its core, you know, it may even be postmodernist or deconstructionist by its nature. Because it's all about the models. It's all about the math. It's all about looking at this stuff as a bunch of little moving parts as a system. It's always about reducing something. You could even say trivializing something. Okay? I mean, it's about saying, here's this wash of complexity. Let's talk about how it works and break it down into this little spreadsheet. Right? And what that means is that you were always simplifying these complicated things, like, you know, the inner core of a person's soul and turning it into 8 bars, and reducing it down to something that is always inaccurate and always oversimplified, and, you know, often, you know, frankly, kind of Manichaean, good versus evil, you know, black and white. And I think that ends up getting reflected in our stories, which are almost always simplistic Manichaean good versus evil stories, too, because that's all the game can support. You know, the games, even what we call analog games, you know, they tend to be binary when you dig into them. But I find this incredibly frustrating and ironic because people like the group in this room, game designers, have some of the most varied sets of interests of any people on the planet. Certainly that I've ever met. I mean, you go to a university and you talk to the specialists in each field, and frankly, they know nothing about anything except whatever it is that they study, which they know to such excruciating detail that you don't want to hang out with them. And, you know, you get a group of us together. I mean, in the car on the way here, we discuss the scientific underpinnings of astrology. You know, at a design workshop I was at recently, we were trading book recommendations, and it was, you know, what's the latest good hard-boiled detective novel versus what's a better history of America pre-1492, right? And, you know, you look around at designers, even the ones who occasionally, you know, I've got this wonderful photo of Will Wright at Georgia Tech. They have a version of Facade there that's a full immersion room, and they actually make you put on a little VR headset and goggles, and they actually mount a keyboard on your back so an operator can come and fiddle with what's going on while you're going. So I have this wonderful photo of Will Wright being programmed. And, you know, but even people like Will, who sometimes seem, you know, cybernetic to some degree, you know, you talk to him, and he's got interests all over the map, right? I mean, he likes to build robots, but he likes to build robots in order to leave them piteously mewling on the street to see what people will do when they come up against this dead robot. Help me! You know, and then videotapes them. So, as a group, I mean, we're really well read. We're interested in all kinds of different stuff. But when I look at the industry, our influences, I guess the word I use is paltry. You know, they're I mean, it's pathetically small. So, I mean, who was playing Cooking Mama yesterday? Yeah, the industry's reaction is, a game about cooking? You know, and then you play it, and it's actually WarioWare reskinned. And it's, you know, another little spreadsheet about reaction times. And, yeah. It's so frustrating, right? I mean, we reduce it down to the same little set of reductionist, almost deconstructionist mini-games that become a parody of cooking, right? But at least it exists, and there are glimmers of, I mean, we played Werewolf last night. There are things there that aren't just this. Although, you know, you sit and you play Werewolf and you quickly start going, you know, there's an algorithmic approach to this. You've got the villagers together, damn it.
That's why you were killed first.
I know. So I guess the question when I look at the game about cooking and I go, why stop there, right? So there's an easy step to the game about winemaking. You know, and I say, let's make a game about winemaking. And in your heads, you immediately start going, dry season versus wet season, acidity of the soil. You know, there's all kinds of things like that. And you go, okay, so let's go a step further. What about the game about wine tasting? Yeah, I don't know enough about wine tasting to figure out even how. Yeah, you want to play that game, don't you? live action. Why Jason get
weird? DRG.
And then I go, well, wait a minute. What about the game? You know, I just learned that all of the peach orchards between, Harvard 35 and Round Rock are gone. Which sucks.
They're all Walmart. The pits.
Yeah. And, you know, and I go, why is there no game about the taste of a freshly picked peach straight from the tree and the smells and dust of the working orchard? How do you make a game about that?
Well,
but,
it
isn't just an interface problem. It isn't just an interface problem because, you know, there are probably poems about the taste of the fresh peach.
The interface problem would be reading about peaches, right? How can you read about peaches?
Yeah. So, you know, the game about the dynamics of a coral reef and destroying a coral reef, you know, when we think about that, we immediately go, oh yes, serious game, and we'll teach people about global warming. And it's like, that's not the same thing as really a game about coral reefness, you know? And why isn't there a game about silk screening t-shirts, right? Well, what is it that makes us go, yeah, that just doesn't come up. Let's go for the orc slang instead, right? At this very moment, there's probably more teenagers out there interested in silk screening crap onto t-shirts than there are in slaying orcs, and yet it just doesn't come up. The game about the difference between the warp and the weft and the art of tapestry making. I mean, hey, could we make a tapestry making game? Shit, that one's even math, right? But it doesn't come up. It just doesn't come up because our influence set is so small. And even those areas where we do have the control, right, where we could go in and say, hey, let's broaden our set of influences, let's draw in material from more sources. I mean, just look at art styles, right? The styles that we have are Japanese anime, gray-brown photorealism, and the cartoons that we loved as kids and still love because we're geeks who won't grow up. And that pretty much sums up the entire video game art style. Why isn't there a fucking pointillist video game, dammit? Why isn't there an impressionism renderer? It's just not there. Why is no game gone visually where Picasso went? It's not because it doesn't work. Once upon a time, Picasso was shocking. Nowadays, you know, you walk into a generic hotel on the road, you're just as likely to see something cubist as you are to see a watercolor landscape. We take it for granted. Everybody knows how to read that now. You know, it's no big deal. We haven't done, we don't even scratch the surface on these other art styles and influences and sources of inspiration. We do rhythm games, and we can't fucking do melody games. And we just don't do them. There are no melody games. We kind of have Guitar Hero, but it's really a rhythm game with five drums, right? I mean, we're so caught in this little rut. And the challenge is I don't have any answers. When I wanted to know what it felt like to flap, you know, I'd love to show you the first prototype. It's a little wireframe bird, and up in the corner, you get to see all of these floating point variables scooting around, right? Which are, you know, angle of the wind and angle of each feather and, you know, all the swirling by this little haze of numbers. And, you know, flying and flapping is not rotation angles of wing bones and force of air propelled. And yet, when we put something into a game, that's what it turns into. Now, it's not that there aren't mechanical activities that do just fine. Flying a plane is, you know, it's flow of air over the wing and blah, blah, blah. And then we've managed to mimic that pretty thoroughly and well. And at this point, you know, it's damn close. We have the sensation of flying and playing pretty good. But I wonder how we take in all of the influences that are not systemic and taking in the games that reflect non-systemic reality without quantizing it. You guys know the word quantize? The musicians, particularly the ones who work in electronic music in any form, will know it, right? This is where you take the music that you play and don't quite nail the timing on, and you tell the computer, please nudge the notes over by fractions of a second so that everything is lined up with perfect rhythm. That's called quantizing. Fortunately, there is an opposite process, which is to take something perfectly played and nudge the notes slightly out of place so it doesn't sound like it's being played by a robot, which is called humanizing, actually. That's the full note. You know, and one of the questions I end up asking is, have I been trained, right? Because games are about learning, to my mind. And, you know, you learn about models from playing games, right? You learn to understand that model that the game is presenting you. That's the learning exercise. What is the shape of the spreadsheet? What are the rows? What are the columns? What are the math operations I can perform on it? That is what games teach you, right? So I wonder, because I've been playing video games since I first got that Pong console from Sears, right? Whenever that came out in the mid-70s, one of the knockoff ones, right? I'm of the generation that has been playing video games since, right, basically. Have I been trained by them to only see the world as something that can be quantized? Have I been trained by them to come to Werewolf and immediately say, okay, so the algorithm is? That's a little scary because there is a big difference between shades of gray and a byte's worth of grayscale. Right? Big, big, big fucking difference. When my wife and I were first dating, we were on one of the Apple campuses when they just got the color Macintoshes. And if you remember that time period, all of a sudden all of the games had these beautiful color gradients in the background. And we would go outside and we'd look at the sunsets over cornfields on the eastern shore of Maryland. And we'd say, hey, look, Mac colors. Long ago, you know, the kind of whole deist philosophy was that the metaphor of God was the watchmaker. And I've started to wonder whether games make the world into clockwork. And whether this is honest. So, it might be that games and us as designers of them, you know, we're just filling a role, right? I mean, there is a huge amount of value in seeing the world as clockwork. A huge, huge, huge amount of value. And arguably, it's a very progressive way to look at the world because it takes out a lot of, frankly, stupid shit that has killed millions of people throughout history, right? Being able to approach the world in this very scientific way and deal with it in terms of algorithms and so on, you know, it can help because it makes you see the stuff that is just blatant superstition or, you know, false pattern matching, or, you know, the real reason why two groups hate each other will actually be about, you know, calorie intake and not about religion, you know. So seeing the world as clockwork and doing those spreadsheets, it's an incredibly valuable exercise. And this clockwork world has to be in the picture along with all the other ways of seeing the world, right? I mean, our worldview has to become, you know, over time, and it inevitably will, right? Like lots of layers in Photoshop making up one picture, where we will see the world in many, many, many different ways. And the clockwork way is a very good one, but I sometimes wonder whether we're stuck in our layer and whether we can participate in the broader side of things. And when we go to this broader side of things, the world where there is a game about tree-ness or the, you know, the experience of being bark, you know, whatever artsy-fartsy thing I can come up with, when we bring it back with us, will we always be pixelating it, paletting it, building low-poly versions of reality, right? Will we always be turning it into something mechanical? I mean, do a thought experiment right now. Shut your eyes. Good, they're all doing it. And imagine something that you dream about at a moment of experience. You know, it could be, I don't know, God, it could be laying on your back watching the clouds, shape around. It could be the first time that you and your boyfriend or girlfriend or whichever it was or both snuck out in the middle of the night and went for making love under the stars. It could be the first time you ever saw the ocean. It could be that moment when, you know, I keep pulling nature examples, how romantic poet of me. But it could be almost anything. The first time you realize that the computer would jump through hoops and do your bidding, right? I mean, those moments of wonder that Nicole was referencing, okay? And now here's the thought experiment. Build me the game system right now in your head and tell me if that dream just didn't blow to bits. And that's the challenge that I guess I want to leave you guys with, because it's not that this way of looking at the world is bad. It's not. The challenge that I leave you with is whether or not games are irredeemably spreadsheets in this sense. And I don't mean the stories we tack on top of them. I don't mean the pre-art that we can call art and stories. No, they can do this. We know that. The challenge that they do is whether games can do it on their own without being propped up by all this other stuff. It might be the answer is no. And if it's no, the question I'll leave you with is, okay, then, what does that mean for those of us who make them? You know, are we all watchmakers? Okay, watchmaking is a noble profession, you know. And think about what does that mean for all of the kids whose brains we currently control. That what we're doing is teaching them to see the world as clockwork orreries. And what that means. That's the challenge I'm leaving with.
One thought to send you off into your break. How long of a break? 10? Okay. One thought is, I'd like to work. There is a strong, strong commonality between the four talks that you heard. Yeah. And in my mind, it's something like this, you can interpret it better if you can or want to.
You're dirty.
Thank you. Because over here are metrics, and we need them. And over here is a peach. And there's a what the fuck is this in between? Clouds for Nicole. You know, this is fun over here. These are the measurements. Every one of us talking to you has invested hugely into using science to do metrics, to make tools. We're very heavily invested in that shit. And then, we all over here have magic, where we have, you know, why more than four games, or something, okay? In my talk, for me it was art here, and it was science here, and while we talked about some of these things piercing George's wall, well, let's get rid of George's wall, it's not George's wall. There is something here that we're all looking at from both sides and trying to either define or just skip the fuck over. And I think that I'm getting an indication we're all good here, but you know what? Seems that everything that Will Wright shits makes a pretty good story. So that's something I want to send you off into your 10-minute break, and we'll come back and we will start eating this fucking elephant one bite at a time. Let's go. 10 minutes.
There's three meals.